This is the Hear Hear podcast. Tonight we are joined by Matt Avitable, adjunct professor at SUNY Oneonta and owner-operator of the Mountain Eagle newspaper. Welcome to the program, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the drive out.
Absolutely.
You found us. We've said this a couple of times. We're going to put a sign out there eventually, maybe a flag.
Found you on the first try, too.
Oh, there we go. All right. All right. We're doing better. We were just talking about newspapers. It's an interesting to try to do print in a digital era.
Mm-hmm.
How is that?
Stressful. In fact, listeners can't see it, but I've gone completely bald during my time at the paper, and I started with hair, so just to give you a little bit of an indication.
What's the timeline on that? How many years?
8.5.
8.5 years, you will lose your hair.
Pretty much, yeah, if not sooner.
Yeah. So the Mountain Eagle is kind of the umbrella newspaper, but you have multiple newspapers under that.
Multiple sections, yeah.
Yes.
So the paper originally was the Mountain Eagle, and since I was involved, we've been able to expand and bring in new sections, usually tied around geography. So the mm-hmm. Windham Journal went out of business, so we opened the Windham Weekly. We hired Mike Ryan, who is the editor. Catskill Mountain News went out of business. We opened up the Catskill Chronicle, which includes Brian Sweeney, who is the editor of the Catskill Mountain News. We've been able to expand as time goes on and bring in quite a bit of content.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah, and use people who are already very well ingrained in it and known in the community.
Absolutely.
Mike, it comes to all of our events. He was at the they've been doing at the VFW. They've been doing
the bingo night,
and he does everything with the community center. Very, very present.
Absolutely,
which is amazing.
And
yeah.
that's what was important, is to bring in people with a lot more experience than I had, because I had no formal journalism training when I got involved with the paper. So I've been able to bring in effectively people with decades of experience. In fact, when my father worked at the Mountain Eagle before I was born, he worked with Mike Ryan.
Oh, wow. Oh. So, okay, so with no journalism background, why take the plunge? What was the...
There were a lot of reasons, too, but I wanted a challenge. That was definitely part of it. Part of it was I spent 8 years as the mayor of my hometown up in Middleburg, and I promised everyone I wasn't going to run. And I knew that I was going to need something to do, keep myself occupied. So when the paper came up for sale, I jumped on the chance. I also wanted a chance to work with my father, who's the editor of the Scary section.
Oh, awesome. Oh, so it's family business.
Ran.
Yeah,
that's a little
awesome.
Bit, yeah.
Family business. So you were mayor of Middleburg?
Yep, from 2012 to 2020.
Ah, small town government.
Say no more.
Yeah.
No, it was definitely worth it. It's the best thing I ever did. But it was definitely stressful. I came in right after the flood. I left right at the beginning of the pandemic.
Oh, wow. Good time to get out.
It was very stressful. It was very hard.
Yeah.
That was my major goal as a young person, was to become mayor, and I did, and our team did everything that we promised, did it over the course of 8 years. I didn't realize that I was interested in owning a paper, but I've always been interested in papers. I grew up with my dad working at different papers, following him around. He'd cover stuff, deliver papers. So while I didn't study it in college, it was kind of like second nature. I knew you had to show up to do this, do that, deliver, and a lot of the different elements I had practice in just growing up. So when it came down to buying it, I used a lot of my skills that I acquired as mayor to give it my shot. And luckily, 8.5 years later, we've grown dramatically. When I bought the paper, its readership was 450. And as of the end of last year, we wound up with more than 3,600. So
nice.
We've really been able to grow it quite a bit.
Awesome. And that's cool. That's cool in a digital era.
Oh, without a doubt. And the thing is, too, is demography, time is not on our side.
Yeah.
A lot of the folks who do buy papers, they're moving to Florida. Some are passing on. This is not easy. And I knew that it was going to be a challenge from the very first day.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, looking forward, what is the approach to something like that? I mean, I think there's something, I'll always be a person that buys a book and reads a book versus a Kindle or trying to do it on my phone or anything like that. I think there's something beyond nostalgia that holding paper and reading paper is, you could say, like, one of the most basic human things to do, right? It's right. Like, that's how you gain knowledge. That's how you, you know, you learn what's going on in the community around you. So is that, I mean, with such a good growth in subscriptions, hopefully something that can keep on.
We hope. I mean, I have to be honest with myself that demography and time are not on our side.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, I'm hoping to bring in a new cadre of readership. I'm hoping to appeal to people under 50, that when people are approaching middle age and getting a little bit older, that they're going to be more involved and more interested. It's still really difficult. There are fewer people in general that read papers. I saw this graph the other day about newspaper ad revenue. Peaked around 2000. And it's fallen by about, I don't want to get the percentage wrong, but more than 80% in the last 25 years.
Yeah.
And readership, I'm sure, is not that dissimilar. So it's going to be difficult no matter what. But I've given my effort, and we've built a really good team, and that's what's made it work.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because you, I mean, there's a pretty substantial portion of your revenue that is advertisement,
mm-hmm.
right?
Absolutely.
So keeping that going. That's an interesting, I wonder, because I'm seeing it in our age bracket where people are very interested in, you can get kind of lost in news of the state and news of the country and news of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And people are kind of honing into their community and focusing on stuff that's right around them.
And that's been really important to me, because there's a lot of newspapers that their focus is the bigger picture, and that's their role. For us, we keep national stuff out. Unless it's relevant to the area, we keep state stuff out. We're trying our best to be just for Green, Delaware, and Scary counties and not have, like, partisan politics, not have national stuff taken in, because sometimes you'll get people and they don't want to get involved because there's some national issue that they're concerned about and they want us to proselytize for them or bash another side, and it's just not the role of a truly local paper. Yeah, we're not corporate owned. We don't have, like, I like the AP, but we don't have AP stuff. We don't have stuff from a corporate chain. It's what we produce.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost 100% locally sourced.
Yeah. Yeah. And with this, I mean, you're talking the, as you guys picked up other newspapers and brought people in. So it's gathering that information and putting all that information together is a task.
Absolutely. We have about 50 towns now.
Wow. Is it, so do you have like a Mike Ryan? Is it kind of they try to cover as much as they can, or do you have a branch? Do you have kind of people in each area, or are you looking for people in each area?
It's both. We're always looking, but more people want to write than we need. A lot of times we need half of the newspaper's writing and photography. The other half is logistics.
Mm.
Logistics are, as Napoleon supposedly said, and Omar Bradley said, that strategy is for amateurs and logistics is for experts, and it's getting the paper out, it's getting it printed, it's driving it places. We have about 175 drops between the different towns, so it is difficult. But to answer your question, yeah, we have Mike here in Windham, who does an excellent job. My father up in the southern part of Schoharie County. We have Josh Walter in the Colville-Skill area. We have Liz Page in Stamford. We have Brian Sweeney, who just retired and went part-time in the Margaville area. So we've been able to have, like, point people, and then we have additional, like, experts in particular fields that will assist, and then a whole bunch of freelancers. So we've been very fortunate. I've been trying to get people in that know more than I do to use it to our advantage.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that – I love that. I say that so often in so many projects that I personally do, is, like, I want people that – are smarter than me and know more than me, because it's only going to make everything work better. So surrounding yourself with a powerful team. So when it comes down to, we kind of talked about this a little bit before we went on to Mike's, was it when it comes down to the day,
mm-hmm.
you know, Wednesday night, you're printing Wednesday, it's going out Thursday morning. Talk us through that. I mean, that has to be the ultimate pull it together, man. Let's go, right?
So things have changed over the years. Some ways have gotten significantly easier, and some ways have gotten more complex as we've grown. So I'll run you through a week where, let's say, I have to do certain things. What I originally, I was doing two-thirds of the drops myself. I was getting the papers. We used to hand-label them on my kitchen table, hand-bag them, get them out in the mail. It was really hard. I'd work at the college till about 7:30, 8:30 at night, drive to Schenectady where we were printing at the time, pick up the papers, come home, hand label them myself, and then about 2/3, 3/4, I delivered. So I'd used to get back at 2:30 in the morning. I used to do this route right near Wyndham, get back at 2:30 in the morning, sleep, and then go teach my 8 a.m. class at Colville-Skill. So it was a lot. It was quite a bit for a while. But over time, I've professionalized the different services within the paper. So we went from 2 routes to 5. I no longer have to put together the entire paper. So the
at your dining room table.
Absolutely. So on Wednesday, what happens is I get the copy of the paper. Mm-hmm. Amanda gives me the paper about 80% complete, sometimes a little bit more, sometimes a little bit less. And then from about 6 or 7 till a little after 11, we're putting together anything that needs to be added, late stories, making sure that things are where they need to be, check for typos. We've been running 52 pages usually, which is a lot.
That's a lot.
For a paper of our size. So going through every single element, we do every single thing in-house except for print. We print with the Times Union out of Albany.
Okay.
So tomorrow night, for example, I'll be getting the pages in. I send a couple of drafts to the team. They get them back. And then I have to get the pages in around 11:10 to the Times Union. I have to. They're waiting on me.
Yeah.
So I get them in, and then they print over the course of about an hour and a half. So tomorrow, for example, I'm going to get the pages in around 11. I'm going to give them an hour and change the print, and then I'll be there probably 1:30, pick up the papers. So originally I had my little hatchback Mitsubishi Mirage. I could pick up all the papers and have someone with me and have room to spare. I mean, my tires would, you could see the suspension in the back go down.
Squatted, yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. And then over time we evolved. So 5 years ago I bought a Ford Transit van, which is like the size of a minivan. And yep, that was like huge for us. And like in many ways, metaphorically and physically, like we'd fill it up about halfway. And then we kept growing, which I didn't really expect, especially due to the pandemic, which is a whole other story. So last year, we bought a blue Nissan Envy 8-foot tall van. So I'll be driving that to Albany to pick it up. And for like special editions, we're filling that. We're not quite going up to the roof just yet, but as far as like practically full, like without stuff tipping over, we're getting there now, which I didn't really ever anticipate.
Yeah.
So I'll be picking them up. I got a couple of drops coming back to Middleburg to hand off the papers for our other routes. And hopefully I'll be done by about 3:15. And then assuming I'd have to do a route, then I would normally during the school year go teach, come back, and then run a route. It's the summer for 2 more weeks. I don't have to. So what I probably do is rest up a little bit, maybe get a good night's sleep, and then head out at noon. And then depending on the route that you have, 4 of the 5 are about the same in time. They're all about 4-5 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So assuming I have to come down to Wyndham, I'd probably come down through Grand Gorge, cut over to Hunter first, come up through Hensonville, do Wyndham, go to Cairo and Durham, and come back. And that's usually about 5 hours. That's if I don't have a double route.
There is no quick way.
Not really. And the thing is like, you got to do it, and you can't not get the papers out. So I have all the routes pretty well memorized.
Yeah.
Just from experience, because for years I was it. I was the show.
Yeah.
So that's a taste of what we do.
So it comes from the Times Union Assembled.
Correct.
Yeah, so that's awesome. So you pull it, put it in the van, and you're on the go.
Correct.
You're right to it.
Since we have different sections on the front, we used to do that also by hand on my kitchen table, but we eventually talked the Times Union into doing it for us because they have this team. I would have to come and my friends, employees, family, whoever would help me assemble them on my kitchen table, and then you'd have to stack them all, and you'd have to rubber band them and get them out. I mean, there's an entire process between mail and reorganization that luckily the Times Union, we pay them for, and it's complete. So we still have to stack a lot and get a lot of mailbags in and get everything all set and separate them. But it's a lot simpler than it was, let's say, last year or 5 years ago.
Yeah, than even last year.
Oh, absolutely. We switched over to having them assemble them in September of last year.
So you were saying something about the pandemic caused it, caused a shift. Mm-hmm. What was that?
People coming up from downstate, honestly. So multiple things happened, but the paper had grown. I was proud of the job that myself and the team did, but, you know, we had grown to about 1,700. And that's good compared to where we started, but it wasn't great. Like, it was difficult, and there were people that still didn't get the impression that the paper was that large. Like, even when I started, I would ask people, I'd say, I'm calling from the Mount Eagle, and twice people actually said to me, I thought you were out of business. And not in a mean way, not in a way to put me down, but they actually thought that. So the pandemic happened, and it seemed like everything was going to fall apart. People were not going to go out and buy the newspaper. There was not going to be stuff to report on. Village, town, county meetings would not be happening.
Right.
And that would be that. And so I had to put in contingency plans where I figured, you know, this is it. Do I lay everyone off? Do I continue on? We had to do one layoff temporarily, and that was it.
Wow.
And that was even just temporary. We wound up keeping everything. So if you look at the chart that I like my chart where I track circulation, went down like a little bit in March-ish of 2020, maybe into early April. And I was doing most of the drops myself because I couldn't. I figured if everything's going to fall apart, I can't afford to have other people do it. So I had some of the routes go under my my tutelage. And so I took on all those routes again, except for one. I was doing the paper myself. It was really weird. It really felt like everything was going to end. And then we get into like April, May, and then our sales start to surge because people are coming in and they're escaping the pandemic. They're staying at an Airbnb. They're staying at a second home. They're buying second homes, sight unseen.
Yeah.
And Schoharie County, we did fine where I'm from. But then in Delaware and Greene, it was like amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, our sales numbers almost doubled by the time the main part of the pandemic ended.
Holy shit.
Like, it was something I just did not, you could not have asked me about it before. I would not have believed it.
Right.
And it wound up being something where then the readers came in, and then a lot of the places that were struggling came to us. They came to us and said, well, they didn't say these words, but there's all these city folks. How do we get them to our restaurant? We want to advertise. And then the real estate advertising took off because as our readership grew and people were looking for real estate, people in real estate realized that we had something really valuable because there were people that were coming up for the weekend or for the week because of the pandemic, and they were looking for a home. And if they saw it in the paper, there was a good chance that they would actually bid on it without going and seeing the house. And I think a lot of real estate companies realized it. So ad revenue started to increase. Circulation almost doubled. It was never, ever would have imagined. Then what happened was because we got that big surge of credibility, that also happened during a time when the news landscape started to fall apart. When I started, the Delaware County Times went out of business. Windham Journal went out in 2018. The Catskill Mountain News went out in early 2020, right before the pandemic. The Times Journal out of Cobleskill wound up with some struggles. And so all these different regions basically started seeding news landscapes. And so we wound up surging all over. And then once we started growing, it became an issue where, like, became a lot more credible. So then other people started reading and we launched new sections. So between 2021, 2022, we wound up launching a section for Cobleskill, section for Margaville. We wound up rebranding a section for Schoharie around the same time. Like, we wound up with a really significant growth that I still don't fully believe. But I'll gladly accept.
Something that you would look back on and say, there's no way I could have seen that happening. But I think what I said earlier is reading a hard copy is such a basic thing. And I think there's a saturation of global and national news where people are kind of like, I just want to know what's going on here.
Correct. And that's a huge part of our readership because since we don't take sides nationally, I think it's kind of refreshing.
Yeah.
You do get folks that really come and say, that they kind of assume that we match their politics just mm-hmm. because we have some attribute that they also have.
Yep.
But many of our writers, I don't know their politics. I don't ask their politics. Yep. I don't want to know their politics. Sometimes you can figure it out. Sometimes they'll tell you. But generally, it's you leave everything else out. Unless something national happens locally, we're not touching
not
it. You can write a letter to the editor if you want, but that's as far as we're going to go. And it's really helped because it seems like a lot of the other newspapers, especially those that belong to chains, they have a political point of view, and I just don't see a reason to, other than local politics, of course.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Well, as a history professor, is there a part of you that sees the newspaper as history being written?
Is like, that famous phrase, yeah, that news is the first draft of history. Not really. You know,
so that's not why you got into it?
No, not at all. Okay, not at all. So
it's so funny. I had him.
We have lots of local history. My friend Tim, who's currently the mayor of Middleburg and previously served as managing editor of the paper, he's a columnist now, he always would write with this idea that this is the first draft of history. He tends to write like big picture stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good, and he's a good writer, but I don't see it that way. I mean, in a sense, I understand that. In a sense, I realize in 100 years, someone's going to be looking back at the archive and, you know, recognizing when some major change happened in town, a building burned down, a flood happened. And I understand that.
Mm.
But I don't like looking at it like that. I like to try and be as objective as possible rather than giving too much of a credence of that I understand more about where things are headed. Generally speaking, than the average person.
Okay,
does.
I like that. Yep.
As much as that's really tempting.
Being objective for right now, not looking at it as something that's influential for the future or putting that kind of weight onto it.
Correct. And one of the big problems that media in general has is that we have people that they know the story they want to write before they do their research.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that I'm perfect, but generally speaking, you're looking at a situation where if it's anything controversial, you actually want to understand it before you get too far into it.
Yeah.
And there have been times where you see this either locally or nationally, where someone has a point of view and they want to fit the different pieces to say something. And you don't want that to happen, at least not on anything controversial. If you're doing a thing on Girl Scouts, that's fine. But if you're talking about potential fraud, you're talking about demographics, you're talking about big picture political stuff, you don't want to write your story backwards. And I see that a lot.
Yeah. Prying it to fit a shape. Right.
Absolutely.
It's like, I mean, we could use that on national news. Would be great if we could kind of filter all national news that way, where it's that, you know, why are it has an agenda as soon as it comes out the door.
Well, and that's one of the major problems with national news is there's been efforts to create like nonpartisan sort of channels, and you see some of them on the internet, but they're not ratings bonanzas because people want to watch things that they tend to already agree with, and that's very difficult. And you tend to get attention by writing or saying really controversial big stuff and trying to like fool the audience and leave them on a cliffhanger. I don't like a lot of headlines with question marks. I think there's a what's called Betteridge's law of journalism, which says if a headline ends with a question mark, the answer to the question is usually no.
Mm.
So unless there's a specific reason, we don't do that. And then I try to keep very simple headlines. So it's not something bigger picture, unless it has to be. If there's a fire, you could say fire in Middleburg, you know, destroys house. You don't need to add in an opinion. There are times and places for that.
Yeah.
There are times and places where I put something like opinion or analysis on top so people know that I'm saying something that's opinionated, or I'll put an author's note in front. But if you are going to claim to be objective, then you need to give it a shot. And my hope is, with our writers not knowing all their politics and then knowing who's a little bit about some people that are more left of center, some that are more right of center, is that it's like balance, that I'm not going to wind up like putting through a purity test where someone has to agree with me. And I tell people when I first meet them, like, I'm not going to tell you my politics. You're not going to tell me mine. Because as much as I want to and as much as I follow national stuff, being mayor of a small town, it's by state law, it's a nonpartisan position. I cannot run under a party. I could not run under a party. And when you represent a small town, you wound up with taking office right after a flood, you can't think of terms of partisan stuff. This isn't national. This isn't something where you have to consider. This is your neighbor Betty needs something.
And for the record, that was Irene.
Correct.
And that was
2011.
And that was one of the most devastating natural disasters on the mountaintop, as well as down through the Schoharie Valley.
Oh my gosh, yes, I just came through Prattsville. I mean, between Greene, Delaware, and Schoharie County, it was a defining moment, and that flood basically made me mayor, and you can't think partisan. So over 8 years, you know, I wanted to, you know, I might support certain ideas one way or another, but the village board is not going to write a letter to Washington to say such and such, so on and so forth. You might do it to Albany.
Mm.
Because there might be something directly affecting your village, but I don't like big, like, signing statements and saying, like, we want some big policy with that has nothing to do with the village. So our board is nonpartisan. I made sure that our board was nonpartisan. So that basically got drilled into my mind for 8 years that I can't go one way or another. It has to be for the best of everyone, because you're not going to ask someone's political party before you clean out stuff in their house after a flood.
No, absolutely. Right. In moments like that, everybody's making sure they have a place to sleep, that they've got what they need out of what's left of their home. And, you know, in those moments, it removes all of those preconceptions about each other. And, Main Street, everybody comes and they're helping each other and they're digging out. And it's just, it levels all of those things that seem so important or seem like such a big deal. And when it comes down to it, it's like, it's...
Absolutely.
It's not. Yeah, it's not.
And that helped a lot. One of the silver linings that happened due to the flood was... We have all sorts of stuff that happens in any village. All towns and villages do. And some of it's big and some of it's petty. But for a brief moment, almost everything went away. And it was like we had a lot of momentum where people were more focused on the reconstruction than their own personal pettiness. I'm not saying everybody, but enough where there was a real unity in purpose where people actually got together. And then once results started to come in, people were really... coming together, and by being nonpartisan, saying like, my goal is to clean up after the flood, my goal is to set things back up better than where we were, it wound up making a big difference. And, you know, there was a lot of concern at the beginning because, first off, I was 25. And so the idea of putting a 25-year-old in charge of a village was not easy.
Yeah.
So it went from me defeating the mayor at the time with 53%. And then over time, I wanted to not judge people by partisanship and then let people, if regardless of who they supported, that they were, I keep care of everyone equally. You know, I'll go and I'll shovel your driveway. I'll help you pick up your groceries. I'll try to keep your taxes low no matter who you are.
Yeah.
And so that allowed me to win the second time with 90%. And then after that, I was like, I promised to only do two terms. I'm not going to be a politician. I'm not saying it's never going to happen. My hope is never to run for anything again.
Mm.
And just do what I wanted to for the community that I love so much and,
oh, amazing.
And
yeah.
Contribute.
Yeah, amazing. So what was it about that time period that made you want to run for mayor?
I wanted to before the flood.
There
was no mistake. Like,
yeah.
I had been on the village board for 5 years.
Okay.
I had experience. I first got elected. I lost my first time when I was 19. I won when I was 20.
Mm-hmm.
I served parts of two terms. And I had planned to, but everything that had seemed so important before the flood, most of it wound up just going away because a lot of those petty things are not as important as the overall survival of your community. Because if you mess it up, you can kill a town. Like, it'll still be there. It'll still be on the map. But, I mean, look at any place in the Appalachians or the Rust Belt where,
brutal,
you know, towns are there.
Yeah.
But you lose, you know, the brain drain. Young people move away. So I wanted to run. I wound up at the right place at the wrong time, basically. I was still living with my father, actually, at the time. I didn't have my house yet. That wouldn't happen for about 6 months, 7 months. And we left. We actually slept in my father's minivan overnight at the town dump because it was elevated just in case the dam broke.
Mm.
And it was awful. And it was absolutely awful. We get down the next day. The mayor had some water on his first floor, so he was in and out. He wasn't there most of the time. Our village clerk, who was studious, and rest her soul, she just passed away after she'd served for 41 years. She was very dedicated to the job, and she wouldn't take vacations. She finally does. She's in Connecticut. The flood happened. She can't get back. Our deputy clerk at the time, who's clerk now, her mother's house was, I don't want to say destroyed because it's still standing, but it was effectively destroyed. They didn't build it.
There was so much of that. Yeah.
So, you know, I wind up going there kind of expecting, not knowing what to expect. We had to pry the door open because it was warped by the flood, and I'm the only one there, and people are coming to pay their water bills and asking what to do. So I'm like, I guess I'll take your money. I have no idea. I have no guidance. And so I put on a cup of coffee. I put a sign outside that said free coffee, and people are streaming in to pay their water bill, which was due within the next 2 days because it's the end of August. And people come in and say, I need this, I need that, or I have a chainsaw, I can help with that. So I started making lists, who has what, who did what. So I asked for and got an emergency village board meeting. We start to organize different things. We had our local accountant, Joe Muniz, and his wife, Joanne, who has passed on, rest her soul. Their house had lost electricity, so their freezer was melting. And they're like, we have all this food. We have two freezers worth of food. And by this point, we can't save it all. So you got to cook it, or it goes away. So yeah. I commandeered two gas grills, and we held a cookout, and we got about 50 people fed, because, you know, a lot of places you couldn't cook in, you know, your kitchen was destroyed,
right,
or you have
right.
no electricity, or whatever the case may be.
Yep.
So we fed about 50 people. It was awful. I could go on. It was the worst 2 weeks of my life, but basically by being there, I accidentally wound up being in charge. I was 24 at the time, not, you know, fully understanding, but I learned a lot. I wrote the Village Emergency Action Plan based on my experience, and there are still a lot of people that when they think of me, they think that I was the mayor during the flood because they came in and asked about whatever the case may be,
right?
And there I was sitting at the desk because there's no one else there. So it was
that's exactly what you meant when you said it. You kind of just got pushed into being mayor.
Yeah, exactly. I didn't really anticipate it. Like I didn't know what to expect, and then you show up and people have questions and you got to figure it out. In fact, I guess the one of the moments that sticks out was Bill, the mayor, was out. I think he was at home. They were trying to deal with the stuff happening at his house. And I get a phone call, and it was like 4 p.m. Most people had headed home. I forget what day this was, maybe 2 days, 3 days after the flood. And there's a voice on the other side, and it's a deep voice, and it says, is the mayor there? And I think my brother and sister might have been there, and I think the town supervisor was in the front, but I was the only one like actually active right then. So I said, no, but I'm the closest thing you're going to get. I don't know who it is. It could be anyone. And he says, oh, well, please tell the mayor, this is Andrew Cuomo, and I want to, you know, let him know that I'm coming to town later today. So eventually we got a hold of Bill, and Bill wound up going to this event with the governor, and I stayed put, you know, at the office. Senator Gillibrand came by, and the only thing I told her was, have you seen the mayor? She says, no, where is he? So I like pointed her to, like, my job was not to come and hobnob while people are suffering. My job was hopefully to sit in the office and like get people connected. And we got over 100 volunteers, and I'm still very, very proud of it. We collected $30,000, wound up sending every person, $300 who had first floor damage. All by just like trying, basically. It was like no real experience. It was like, I want to create a fund. The mayor's like, no, we shouldn't. And I was like, I'm going to do it anyway. So we wound up getting that through. And I used all of that those lessons during the pandemic. The only time we used our emergency action plan significantly, we had activated in case of flood, but significantly was during the pandemic. We created a fund to keep our businesses open on Main Street, and they got $3,000 apiece. Thank goodness. Nick Juried, who passed on earlier this year, donated the bulk of that. We collected stuff for people in case they needed anything. So that experience really came in handy right at the end of my second term as the pandemic was starting.
Wow. Yeah, talk about getting like, right place, wrong time was what you said.
Pretty much.
Yeah, you are sitting in the right seat at one of the, well, definitely the worst within our lifetimes.
Yeah.
But the worst within a lot of people's lifetimes. I mean, there are stories of Wyndham, you know, a lot of the water control up here, the snow melt control up here. I mean, that's what CD Lane is. That's what out on, off of Mitchell Hollow. So it happened, but, you know, for our, I think our parents' generation and our generation, I mean, that was the worst.
Definitely.
That was by far the worst damage we've seen.
Worst in our area since at least 1955, and I think this one was worse. And ironically, Green and Schoharie counties are linked here because we had a lot of rain in our area that caused minor flooding, but a lot was that a lot of the stuff on the mountaintop eventually had to come down to us. So there was some period of severe heavy rain that came through Green County, and not too long after that wound up coming down our area. And we had, oh my God, I could talk all day about the flood, but yeah. it really molded me and gave me a lot of experience. And so a lot of my approach as mayor taught me that, and a lot of what I learned being mayor than I used at the paper. So it's been a continual learning process.
Yeah. Yeah. And but I think that experience, probably being boots on the ground, has definitely had an effect on how you run the newspaper.
Definitely.
Right. Of just being people forward, you know, objective and community forward. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, because that's, when it comes down to it, that's the most functional. Right, that it's the most positive, it's the most functional, is that being the most important.
I have a related story if you'd like. I don't know how much time you'd want me to go on. All right, yeah. So when I bought the paper, there's a much longer story attached to this, but the version that I could fit in the podcast is, we had a lot of volunteers that came through after the flood, and one of them that helped the most was the valedictorian of my graduating class, Josh DiBartolo, who's like a saint. He's the best person I know. Like, and that's not an exaggeration. He is the single best. He gave up a 6-figure job so he could come and volunteer in Middleburg and Schoharie in the area. And so he got involved in the foundation of a group called Schoharie Recovery, which heavily focused on Schoharie. My role in Middleburg was great, like with the team, but what I did was a small fraction of what Josh wound up doing eventually. So eventually Schoharie Recovery got involved with an umbrella that they call Schoharie Area Long-Term Recovery, or SALT, S-A-L-T. And SALT meant to be the umbrella of the organization. There's a longer story attached to this, but about a year, 2 years after the, no, it would have been 2 years after the flood, Josh wound up getting married. He reconnected with a high school sweetheart because he was here volunteering after the flood. He is only here so he could go to his brother's wedding. Stayed here, turned down a big job out west, said he could come and help his neighbors. And no pay, by the way. And he got really sick, so he did eventually take a small stipend and health insurance because he needed it. He was breathing lots of bad stuff.
Yeah.
So Josh, about 2 years in, he makes an announcement. He says, you know, a lot of the hard work is over. I'm getting married. I'm going to move and have a great life. And he has, to his credit. I give him more credit than anyone after the flood. SALT continued operating, unfortunately. And so what they did was they wanted to continue. And so Josh's exit was like a bookend to say, the big role of a flood organization has passed. Let's try and wind things down and help people. But ultimately wind down, not pay people salaries. They continued paying significant salaries and eventually like weeded out individuals as they started to run out of money. And then as the memory of the flood faded, they started to like grant farm. They started like glomming onto other natural disasters. There was a terrible flood down in Texas around 2016. Yeah. And they wound up like that fund had a little left over, so they applied for it. And what they were doing was they're putting it into salaries. And we wound up with people needing help after the flood. They got promised stuff and either they, I don't want to say they didn't get it, but it sure seemed like that. And there are some cases where people just wound up not getting as much as they were promised. And so as mayor, I got to see this. And at first they were like acclaimed. They were one of the other newspapers named the leader of it, the person of the year. And they had all this like acclaim for leading. And after Josh left, they decided that a lot of the practical stuff was over, but they wanted to keep their salaries. And what upset me was the leader, Sarah, was retired. She didn't need a salary and benefits and all that. So when I bought the paper, there was this very real concern, because I started talking to a lot of the people that had been involved with SALT, and they were basically telling me the same thing. They were coming through the AmeriCorps program, which meant VISTA program, which meant they were basically on poverty wages. They're making like maybe $1,100, $1,200 a month, and they would be shopped for by SALT, saying we still have this need after the flood, but the federal rules said you can't actually send someone in to go fix someone's house or muck out someone's house. You got to have them doing like administrative white collar work. So a bunch of these people are talking to me and saying, we're being asked to come in. We have nothing to do. They want us to raise money, but there's no real impetus. We're now dealing with like 5 years after the flood. We're basically wasting our time playing video games in the office. And there was a bunch of them, too. It's not like they had one person and, okay, they just don't have something to do. They were, like, continuing to get these new classes of VISTA, and usually they're, like, 23-year-old, 24, 25-year-old, bright-eyed, you know, kids who want to make a difference.
Make a difference,
and
yeah.
And there's nothing for them to do. So I spent a long time interviewing people, getting help from some of the VISTAs, interviewing people, looking up records. And the first year I got the paper, I decided to go for broke. I needed a story for a big mailing we were doing. We were mailing to a bunch of people in all of Scary County and parts of Delaware and Greene. I was like, I know enough about this. I'm going to write this up. So I used the interviews. I used the different quotes that I got. And I wrote an article, because they had basically funneled $500,000 that appeared to be promised. I'm going to make sure I don't get sued.
Yes.
Appeared to be promised for flood victims into salaries and benefits. So I wrote the article in one draft overnight. I put it together and we mailed it to about 17,000 homes. And it wound up causing them to give up their paid operations. They still exist like as a skeleton. But one of the great injustices that grew out of the flood, that all this money that could have helped our communities regrow wound up going into people's pockets, in my opinion, unjustly, wound up being exposed by the newspaper. And we wound up playing this huge role in finding justice for a lot of the people in Middleburg and Scary and beyond that really felt like they had gotten screwed by this organization claiming that they were helping them. So I was very proud that the newspaper was able to accomplish something for my friends. I mean, one of the biggest cases was they had promised help to my friend Joan. She was on the planning board. And she got really bad breast cancer and died at the age of 81. And by the time, they had promised that she had died. And all this aid that they had been promising her, she never got. And here she is, she dies. And it really broke my heart, because not only were we close, we wound up with these folks, you know, shunting money into their own pockets, people that, in my opinion, didn't need it. Well, here's an old lady dying of cancer who has served her community, who is a longtime history teacher and really good person, has to suffer and die while these promises go unfulfilled for months or years. It just became unacceptable. So I do view the paper as this opportunity to try and make things better if we can. And Hurricane Irene, unfortunately or fortunately, depending how you look at it, was able to show that.
Yeah. Wow. So that went out as like a mailer, or went out in the news?
Okay, it went out as a mailer.
As a mailer
of the newspaper.
Of the newspaper. Okay. Yep. And this was before you owned it.
No, this is 10 months into me owning.
10 months into it.
Yep. So it's November really November 2017.
Wow.
Yeah, it's, I think, the best article I've by response that I ever wrote.
Yeah. Yeah.
So just to answer an earlier question you asked about the first draft of history sort of idea, on rare occasions like that, I tend to look at like, what's the big picture here? It's not just one person complaining that they're not getting flood help. It's like a whole group of people. It's a whole bunch of the VISTA saying the same or similar things. What does this mean in the bigger picture? Because I believe in writing regular boilerplate articles for regular boilerplate things, but for big issues, sometimes I'll write really big articles. I wrote one earlier this year about the senior center. They have some controversy, and the sucker was so big that I had to divide it into two editions, and it wound up being 16,000 words. So it was a small book, but I figure anything worth telling is worth telling completely. I don't want to like have the reader like assume that the reader read something 3 years ago that they might remember or was in another publication. I like to give like, this is where my history background does help. I like to give like citation, explanation, context, that sort of thing. It's not common. These sorts of articles only come out every couple years, but the Salt one was the first and probably the most impactful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's such a... Again, it just goes back to like having the community mind, you know, the community being front and center, right?
Absolutely.
The objective, what works well, you know, for our people, you know, that's the lens.
Absolutely.
Right? That's the filter it should go through. So, wow, what a...
Yeah, I'll send along the article after the podcast is all set, but we wound up with a lot of response. My gosh, we got so many compliments. And the thing is, too, since I cited their tax documents and I had a lot of direct evidence, like, it was really nice in a sense after, because sometimes you know when you have someone dead to rights, like, you can't say, like, well, our IRS form is wrong. Like, you filled it out. Like,
right.
I use that directly. And I think that they kind of didn't, they knew that I was upset about it, but I think they didn't really realize the amount of knowledge that I had gained, the amount of research that I did, how long I worked on it.
Yeah.
I mean, I had been concerned about them for several years at that point and being able to utilize it. In fact, if I hadn't written in one draft, if I had actually taken more time, which I didn't have, probably could have wound up with something even longer with even more data, but I did what I could and I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, that's incredible. Incredible. Huge effort for the community. Huge effort for the local people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's a good, powerful statement as to where you stand as well, right? Being with less than a year into owning the newspaper and saying, this is the rock that I'll, you know, this is the hill that I'll die on.
Oh, and I expected severe consequences. I mean, beforehand, there was, there's a much longer story attached, but there was a real indication that if I published that a lot of businesses wouldn't do business with us. Fortunately, I don't think it came true.
Mm.
But, you know, when the problem was, SALT was seen as the saintly organization, because when people thought about it, they were thinking like the year after the flood, people helping. And so it was like one person said it was like attacking Mother Teresa. But the thing is that their mission had changed so much over the following 4 years after Josh left. I mean, like I said, there was about $500,000 that I tracked that was, in my opinion, improperly used.
Yeah.
That I was willing to ditch everything. Like, I was willing to go out of business over it. I felt that strongly. I didn't expect that to happen. I expected that we'd get some
a little blowback, for
but
sure.
But the positive feedback was astronomical, especially in neighboring Schoharie, because Schoharie had been the center of SALT, and there's so many different like ceremonies and this and that where SALT, like, you know, got these checks or announced these programs that after the first 2 years didn't really live up to their promise.
Mm.
And so a lot of folks there really liked it, and plus a lot of people in Schoharie really liked the way that Middleburg grew after the flood. So it was, I'm willing to take big risks. I think a lot of it had to do with my age, being about 30 at the time, but
yeah,
I feel fortunate.
How you're like, I got time out to rebound from this.
Yeah, precisely. Right? I mean, I was perfectly willing to give any effort that I had to. I mean, shoot, I was going to be delivering the papers at 2 a.m. no matter what I did. So
yeah, right.
I might as well give it a shot. Why else do you have a megaphone other than to use it, hopefully, for positive change?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I could speak to Middleburg. I regularly ride motorcycles from here to Middleburg.
Oh, that's awesome.
And we pop in and, you know, pop into Main Street and get some food and stop for a drink and cruise on, you know. So, yeah, it's an amazing build back.
Absolutely.
You know.
Yeah, I could talk all day about being mayor. It was the best thing I ever did.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think, we won't go too far down this rabbit hole, but I think if people really want to know what it takes to have put the effort in and have an influence, is be involved in some small town governance.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Get out there and put your name in it, and it's like, you know, every bit that's given is, you know, you're giving back to your community. You're working directly with your community, and hopefully if your mindset is that and is to make it better, then every bit of effort that you put in is a positive.
Definitely. And I think one of the things that I've learned over the years is pretty much everyone can contribute in some way, shape,
absolutely,
or form.
Yeah.
And a
absolutely
lot of people, I think, sometimes don't feel that they can, like, mm-hmm, it's too big. But, you know, if you're talking Middleburg, a community of 1,200 people, of course you can, fill in and help out in any way. And sometimes you could take a leadership role. One of the things that I did a lot was sometimes you might want to show up, sit in the back and just be quiet and listen more than anything, learn how things work, get involved. Like, if you want change in, in your community, a lot of times you could do it. People come and say, I really think we should have this event. I'd really like to open this business. I'd like to do X, Y, and Z. And usually we could make it happen. Like, I'm not saying it always happened,
right,
but usually you could.
Yeah.
And one of the things I really liked about my time in office is the mayor has very little statutory power outside of an emergency, like surprisingly little, but there is a lot of influence. There's like the bully pulpit where you can come and hopefully influence things to make your community better. So like you can recruit a pharmacist like we did, recruit a grocery store, recruit the Green Wolf Brewery, do all sorts of stuff to bring in people to make your community better, even if there's no money to do it. It's just to say, I love this community and I hope that you will too.
Yes.
And that helps and that works. And the thing is about our coverage area is we have no large communities. I mean, the largest community is either Delhi or Cobleskill. We have no cities in our area. So every single town in Green, Delaware, and Schoharie that we cover, you can make a difference. You could show up at a town meeting or a volunteer meeting. And, it's amazing to think that, like, your fire departments, your ambulance corps, it's generally speaking made up of people who volunteer, who take time on their own that they could be spending working with their family by themselves, and they give it for their neighbors. And they might not know their neighbors, they might not know their names, they might be close relatives, who knows, but they give that time. Your local events, generally speaking, are volunteers or your small business leaders. And that's part of the reason I try to be positive. A lot of editorials and newspapers tend to be particularly negative, where they try to...
Or divisive.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And one of the things I didn't like is sometimes you'd have other papers and every week they had to have one negative thing in there, like one negative thing in the editorial. It's like, and there are times where you have to, but generally speaking, that's not the point. If someone's trying and things are getting better, you don't have to tear down people for thinking differently. And so a lot of times in my editorials, it's like Wyndham Rotary is doing this, Stanford Rotary is doing that, Middleburg Area Business Association is doing such and such, and isn't it great that everyone's getting along and working on this? Here's a cool event. Here's something else going on in the region that I really think you should know about or I want to commend. Because you really can, like the average person, anyone listening, if you're in a town and you want to donate a couple hours of your time or a couple hundred dollars, like you can make a substantial, like visible difference. And that's one of the best things about being mayor is we were actually able to demonstrate that because a lot of people were very skeptical, especially after the flood. I was 25. And to say, oh, yeah, I'm going to try and rebuild a town and bring back a pharmacy, bring back a grocery store, do this and that. Like, I'm not saying that people laughed at me. I won after all, but it was pretty close to having
skepticism.
Some people laugh. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Don't get me wrong, if I was, if I look at anyone making those promises today, there's obviously a little bit of skepticism many times, but fortunately that community pride tied in with that pride after the flood really surged and it made such a difference. And there's nothing that I could have done that I couldn't do without the team. And team building and relying on your team is absolutely essential at the paper and as being mayor.
Boom. Boom.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. We have certain people up here in Wyndham that have been inspirational for us and that put a lot of legwork into establishing certain things that are happening in the town right now. And there is a leadership by example aspect of it where when you can see, there is skepticism, but they're doing it. They have this going on. And I mean, I could point to multiple things that have happened up here, including this podcast that fed off of the energy of certain people putting the work in, putting the legwork in, establishing something that was their vision. And we kind of I don't want to say rolled the wave, because it wasn't like nobody did it for us, but seeing what's possible, seeing what can happen, and you know, I think for you as well, you've been supportive of us. You know, as soon as I reached out initially, yeah, you were...
We work well together.
Yeah, exactly. And it was, you know, welcomed with open arms. It was like, yeah, let's go. Like, right? Like, yeah, we'll take another column. Let's do it. So,
I think part of what you're talking about is like this idea, like out of Field of Dreams, that if you build it, they will come. Like, once you create an example that people want to follow, and we have two like similar but different forms of media, and the natural thing is to actually make each other's dreams work and actually do this and come down and do the podcast together. This is what makes doing media and in all forms so special.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, pumped that you came down here to do this with us.
Absolutely. I was thinking about doing it on the phone, but I realized, like, it's so much better.
Oh, so much better in person.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Headphones on. Yes.
By the way, for those who can't see the studio, this is like a radio studio. There's acoustic paneling up. We have good wood finish. Like, this has been a really nice experience, not just both the company and how the studio is.
Thank you. Evan put a lot of legwork into that, so shout out, Evan. Do you have an air horn on the board for yourself there, Evan?
I don't. Oh, sorry, man. Cute.
All right. You know what?
I don't like to air horn myself. You know that.
I should have come prepared.
Yeah. All right. So parting shot. What is your personal favorite historical moment? You're a history guy.
Oh my gosh!
You got to have you got to have one. What's a good? What's one of your standout ones that you just
one
like?
Of them? I guess probably I like the Mongol period maybe the most, but the one that I've been reading about the most last 3-4 years has definitely been the Napoleonic era.
Mm.
Like beyond a couple years ago, I read a nice biography on Napoleon. There was also this online debate between two historians that talked about whether he should be called Napoleon the Great. I also read this book, which I didn't know a lot about until I read it, which was about Napoleon's time, the 10 months he was on Elba, as the Emperor of Elba, which is his actual title. So I go out of my way, I mean, to the point where, like, 3 years ago, that was pretty much half of what I was reading, you know, between books, Wikipedia, YouTube videos. There's this 3-hour segment that this YouTube channel does on all of Napoleon's marshals who... my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather had served under when Murat was king of Naples, which I didn't put together until after. But I've watched it and I've listened to it, which is really cool. And then there's a PBS documentary I show in some of my classes. It's a I think it's a 4-part one, so it's about 4 hours.
Mm.
So I've watched or listened to that multiple times. So that's been my squeeze as of late, like the last three and a half, 4 years. So I could go on and on and on. I've been fortunate enough to be teaching now for 15 years, and that's one of the lessons.
Nice. So Napoleon, did he really have a short man complex?
He was average height for his time.
Done. Debate's over. That's it. That's parting shot. That's it. He was an average man for the time. That's it. Matt, thank you for coming down.
Oh, gosh, absolutely.
This has been awesome.
Yeah, absolutely. Go check out thescarehairynews.com.
Excellent.
And subscribe. Get some newspaper. It's $50 for a year.
On stands every Friday.
Every Friday. Absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
And, you know, the way you kind of work, you know, very community-based. I mean, that's kind of how we work, too. So kind of.
Yeah, inspiration, you know, to continue. Yeah. Appreciate it.
I'm glad we get to work together.
Yeah. Me too.
Cheers.
Thanks for coming in. This is the Hear Hear podcast from the Chrisman's Wyndham House Studios. Hosted by Jesse Novak, produced by Evan Gutcha. Thank you for listening. This is the Hear Hear podcast from the Crispin's Wyndham House Studios, hosted by Jesse Novak, produced by Evan Gutcha. Thank you for listening.